Welcome back to Winter is Here, a podcast where we discuss how we arrived at the global battle between tyranny and democracy. And more importantly, how we can win. I'm your host, Uriel Epstein, Executive Director of the Renew Democracy Initiative. Today, I'm excited to welcome my friend Fiona Hill. Fiona was the Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs on the National Security Council from 2017 to 2019. She served as a National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council from 2006 to 2009. Prior to that, she held numerous positions at the Eurasia Foundation in Washington, D.C., where she served as its Director of Strategic Planning, as well as Harvard Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where she served as the Associate Director of the Strengthening Democratic Institutions Project, Director of the Project on Ethnic Conflict in the former Soviet Union, and Coordinator of the Trilateral Study on Japanese-Russian-U.S. Relations. Fiona is currently a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution Center on the U.S. and Europe, and she has published a litany of work on Russian history, Vladimir Putin, and their larger implications for geopolitics. So, welcome, Fiona. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Uriel. Great to be with you. Thank you.
So, Fiona, I think you probably have the rather dubious honor of being one of the people in the U.S. who knows most about Vladimir Putin. So I want to focus today's conversation a little bit on him and how you've come to understand his psychology, his decision-making, and the extent to which that could be useful for our decision-making on Ukraine and to our understanding of other dictators. So, to begin, can you tell me a little bit more about your history with Vladimir Putin?
Well, I can't say whether it's necessarily a history with Vladimir Putin. It kind of makes it sound very intimate there, which I don't want to think about. But certainly, you know, like everybody else, you know, who's been looking at him for a long time, he is actually an incredibly interesting person, not just a political leader. And I actually started at the Brookings Institution in 2000, just as he came into power. I started working with a colleague there, Clifford Gaddy, who was a renowned economist. He's retired from Brookings a couple of years ago. And we both were, you know, watching Putin and his rise very closely. I mean, here is someone who has been a KGB agent. He's the first person of that kind of ilk to get to the head of a major country. And the question, of course, right from the very beginning was that training as a KGB agent and that mindset that obviously comes along with it, be the dominant force in his political personality, or would be this something else that is in his background? And as time went on, it became very clear, obviously, that that was really shaping his outlook in life. But also, after the first few terms of his presidency, and I say a few terms because the guy's been in power now for 22 years and is promising in some respects to be here for yet another set of 12 years after 2024, which would make him the longest serving Russian leader in any kind of modern history, far outlasting Stalin if he stays in power until 2036. But the point was, we realized we knew very little about him because he's the kind of person who had spent a lot of time obfuscating and concealing even some basic facts of his own biography, for example, about his family, you know, his children, you know, basic things that you know, you and I are quite well known to everybody. And, you know, sometimes the Wikipedia version of his biography was just as informative as anything that, you know, the US government had. This is early on. And so my colleague Clifford Gaddy and I decided, after I came back from a stint in the National Intelligence Council, to really try to see what could we get at in terms of understanding, or what could we get, what could we obtain in terms of a deeper understanding of Putin, what makes him tick. And we had to do it really from the context in which he was living and operating. You know, looking at the, you know, what was happening in Russia or the Soviet Union around the time that he was growing up, that when he was rising up through his career, not just in the KGB, but other things he did, and the kind of places that he was. What was it? What were the kind of people that he knew to try to get a grasp of this guy? Because even now, it's incredibly difficult to get any kind of insight into, you know, what Putin is actually thinking about issues. In a democracy like ours, everybody's speculating every 5 seconds about what Biden's thinking. You have, you know, all kinds of different versions. You can have interviews with his family. You see his family and out and about there. With Putin, and increasingly so, in fact, over the last several years, in part because of COVID, he's become cut off. And it's difficult, again, to really penetrate that black box. But I think that, you know, what's been useful for me, drawing on that history of working with my colleague Clifford Gaddy, who 20 years older than me. I mean, we basically were framing Putin by different kind of bookends of ages. I'm a bit younger. I'm the same age as Dmitry Medvedev, who Putin kind of put in his place as president for a period. And Cliff is in his 70s, a bit older than Putin. We were able to sort of corral around the people we knew, the networks we knew in Russia and the former Soviet Union, and, you know, to get a whole set of data points of evidence, as it were, about the kind of things that would shape Putin's thinking. And that's actually still quite useful today. But it doesn't really help, I have to say, in trying to kind of figure out what he's going to do on a day-to-day basis. It just gives you a framework and a contour for understanding the guy.
So before we dive in here, I want to get a sense of what it is that we are fairly sure we know, right? I mean, I remember I sat in on a briefing from a very highly placed DOD source. And I got to say, I was kind of shocked by the fact that, you know, this person shared a story of Putin that, you know, I happen to know it might have been true, but it might also have just been Russian mythology, right? I mean, and it was concerning that a fairly senior level person at DOD was sharing this backstory of Putin that might be no more than myth. I mean, if the CIA had been sharing it, they probably would have said, you know, we assert this with low confidence, with low to moderate confidence. So what is it that we do know? Like, with high confidence, what can you say about Putin and his history?
Well, there's lots of things. I think it's absolutely right for you to cast question marks, because when Clifford Gaddy and I were doing this book, Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin, we tracked down a lot of the stories that had been related by journalists and others. A lot of them came back to Putin. He was the guy who was telling the stories. There was no other source. And it was just, it would go through multiple iterations. You know, he was kind of telling a story about himself and it would get picked up and it would come around. It's like the story that he has in his file in the KGB, that he had kind of a very high tolerance for risk or kind of a low level of fear and concern about things. That just comes from him. And, you know, he spent a whole lot of time basically producing a set of stories about himself for effect, both to bolster himself up as a candidate for becoming president in 2000, but also, you know, to give kind of a certain allure, you know, for people to, you know, shock and awe them about various things, or to, you know, push them off again, obfuscate about, you know, what he's really like. So the only things that I think we can know for absolutely for sure are the things that we've seen ourselves. So I've spent an awful lot of time just listening and to Putin's speeches and watching them and reading them. He gives away quite a lot in his own language. The use of language is what I mean. I mean, and in his own language of Russian, you know, for example, he's very conscious about the words that he uses, the phrases that he deploys, little jokes that he tells. They're very telling about him and the context in which he operates and the way that he thinks. I've spent some time in previous iterations of these Valdai discussion group meetings that are still going on, but they were much more interesting in the very early phases. I stopped going after a while because the propaganda part of the ratio was far too high as opposed to the interesting material aspect from being at these meetings. But watching him in action was really pretty important in terms of gleaning the way that he behaves as well. So I think we actually can have a fairly high level of certainty about how he operates and how he thinks about certain things based on his body language, his language itself, his use of words. And look, by now, after 22 years, we've got a heck of a lot of documentary material about Vladimir Putin and the speeches that he's made, the meetings that he's had and the reports on them, and the number of people who've met him. Because you can also go around and talk to lots of people who've met him in all of these different settings. It's his pre-presidential life that is, you know, the most difficult to penetrate, because there's a lot of myth there, partly created by Putin himself.
So if you were to summarize, let's say, the three most important things that an American decision maker or just any Western free world leader needed to know about Putin, what would those things be?
First of all, the guy operates in a completely different framework from, you know, any kind of US or other international leader. And you have to remember that first of all. He is a rational actor, but completely in his own frame of reference. And that frame of reference is very Soviet. It's also very Russian from his own reading of Russian history and his own interpretations of it. And it's very much the operative's mindset, in the sense that this is a guy who is always looking for some kind of opportunity to do the things that he wants to do and will always try to adapt to any kind of circumstances and setbacks. So that's the first really critical thing. The second thing is that he's pretty ruthless, notwithstanding the fact that a lot of the myths about, you know, things he's done in the past, the stories are from him personally, meant to convey a kind of an idea of ruthlessness. We actually see that he is ruthless. We've got evidence of it. You know, you see what's happening in Ukraine now, that just the devastating attacks on Ukraine are relentless. And, you know, the fact that if there's an opportunity or a kind of an option to escalate, he'll take it. So that's the kind of thing that you can see there as well. And then the third thing, you know, is that he's always carefully calculating and calibrating what he can get away with. And sometimes we can see that he does somewhat pull his punches, or he will, you know, pull back, you know, somewhat, because, you know, he can't really kind of, although, you know, he will double down, as I said before, and he will escalate when he can. At times he will actually recognize that he can't, you know, pursue a certain path. So it's on that element that I think it becomes really important for Western policymakers to focus on. Where have they got evidence of where he has pulled back and pulled his punches? And what does that kind of tell us about some of the calculations that he makes? Because he is calculating.
You know, I mean, it's those two things that I think are important, the rationality and the fact that he will pull his punches if he feels like he has to, right? I mean, this is a man who over the last 20 years has learned. And the problem is we have kind of taught him or given him the wrong lessons. Where, you know, in 2000, you know, with Chechnya, no real Western response. 2008, invasion of Georgia, he is, you know, rewarded essentially with a reset button. 2014, first invasion of Ukraine, 15 bombing of Syria, 20 Belarus, 20 or 21 Kazakhstan. And each time, essentially, the free world has kind of backed off. And so from that, he took a lesson of, oh, well, I can push pretty far. So to what extent do you think the most recent invasion, February 24th, is a logical kind of continuation of these previous provocations to which we kind of failed to respond versus something else, right? I mean, I've read these stories about how he had a mental break. He was so isolated that, you know, he went crazy or, you know, whatever else, right? Like, to what extent is this a logical continuation versus is this something different? Is there something else going on?
I think it can be a bit of both. Not that I think that he's had a mental break or that he's gone crazy, although I think COVID, certainly in that kind of maybe say cabin fever that all of us experienced, certainly had
most
an
of us don't
here.
Invade our neighbors, though, when we experience it.
We don't. I mean, so we usually actually do something else. Some people have done, you know, home remodeling and clearing out the closets, you know, things like that. And, you know, when they weren't actually, you know, suffering egregiously from the pandemic. But Putin was certainly confined, I mean, not just to the Kremlin, because he had plenty of other places that he could go as well, and kinds of presidential dachas outside of Moscow and, you know, down in the Black Sea region, for example. But he seems to have spent a lot of his time ruminating and stewing over Russia's place in the world. And you see an even sharper version. This is why I said it's kind of related to what you said earlier, of an obsession that he started to develop over a period of time, particularly since 2011 onwards, about Russia and the reconstitution of his version of the Russian world as he sort of sees things. And that's something that's been, you know, building up over time, particularly a fixation with Ukraine. And I mean, I think that it's something that we kind of really failed to see as it was hardening, beginning with the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004 onwards. I mean, of course, we saw afterwards the 2006 cutoff of gas to Ukraine by Russia. But we've seen a sort of steady progression, kind of an escalatory trend in Putin and Russia's behavior towards Ukraine. Notwithstanding the fact that I would actually also argue that a lot of this obsession with Ukraine, it's not just Putin's, it's a lot of people around him, goes back to the early 1990s and the immediate dissolution of the Soviet Union, where a lot of people in Moscow couldn't believe that Ukraine, you know, was going off in its own direction, and that the effort to unseat Gorbachev in the last days of the Soviet Union and to create or reconstitute the Soviet Union in this form of a Commonwealth of Independent States had actually been more of a divorce mechanism for the Soviet Union. People like Putin and others really thought it ought to keep together. And so he becomes more obsessed over time with doing something about this. And I do think COVID cemented that for him. There's another element of things, though, that you didn't really go on to mention in the question, the way that you framed this, is Putin also becomes convinced that the West has become dependent on Russia, you know, for oil and gas and other commodities, and also in terms of business. And one of the reasons that he misreads the West ultimately, although it actually he could be forgiven for thinking it's a misreading, is that he's pretty convinced that Western businesses at the highest levels, the largest multinational companies, and a lot of countries with their dependencies on Russian gas for imports from Germany, you know, onwards, are so invested in Russia that there's no way that they would make a break. from the Russian economy. And every time, and these other incidents that you laid out there, that Russia does something, it's that intertwining of the economic issues and the financial issues, because Russia is much more integrated than it ever has been before in the Soviet period, that becomes a constraint on the West rather than on Russia. We always thought that that mutual interdependence would constrain what Russia did. But Putin is convinced that it actually constrains us and not him, that he can exploit and leverage that, because the dependency of the West on Russian commodities, meaning really, you know, Western Europe, is so high.
So I think that's a very good framework for us to look at Putin's decision-making in. I mean, it gives us a strong understanding. But one of the, I think, hobbies of kind of the chattering class and perhaps policymakers and others in the West is to try to kind of read the tea leaves, so to speak, of, you know, his mental state, his physical state, and so forth. And, you know, you are someone whose job it was to offer advice to those decision makers on how to deal with not just Putin, but men like him, but certainly especially him. And so I wonder, you know, especially given that our relative levels of certainty on some of this stuff is limited, to what extent do you think that our understanding of kind of his psychology, of his physical health, and so forth, to what extent should that play in to our decision making? Are these things that we should, you know, be thinking about, or should we be focusing on only actions, right? On only the things that we can see, feel, and touch? Or, you know, should we be making some assumptions as well about some of these other elements that we aren't necessarily certain of?
These are all data points and factors. I mean, you have to have a 360-degree perspective on someone like Putin. I mean, it's also very important that we don't just focus on him exclusively and forget about the fact that there's an entourage, all kinds of different Venn diagrams of people that intersect with him as well. I mean, he doesn't operate in a vacuum, and there's lots of people that would have influence on him, and we, you know, we need to understand that. In the context of Ukraine, for example, a lot of Russians and others have talked a lot about Viktor Medvedchuk, you know, an oligarch in Ukraine who's been very close to him. And, you know, we probably haven't paid enough attention to some of those relationships because, again, we're not completely sure about the nature of them, you know, how often people talk. We have some information, you know, but not a lot. Certainly in Moscow, people that, you know, I'm still in contact with, you know, say that people like Medvedchuk and some of the other individuals around it, Putin's known for years, do have some kind of influence on his thinking. So you've got to figure that out as well. But I think when it comes to these issues about his health, his psychology, it all is actually underscoring the fact that he's the wild card in the political system. The vertical of power in Russia is now so extreme that all focus has to be on Putin and every single one of his attributes. And it's also being watched very closely by other people around him as well. In other settings, for example, in Central Asia, when I was in the National Intelligence Office, National Intelligence Council, we were always, you know, fixated on Karimov in Uzbekistan and Turkmenbashi in Turkmenistan, because there was so much dominance by those individuals in their countries. Everybody was always wondering, you know, we knew they were sick. Eventually they did die. Right. But there was always a kind of a death watch because you had no idea what would happen next, really, because they'd eclipsed everybody else to such an extent in the circles around him that you had no sense of where the country would go afterwards. And in fact, you know, we were quite surprised in some cases about how, you know, differently, particularly in Uzbekistan, the situation proved to be, that somebody that we thought had been completely crushed and squashed in the corner by Karimov, Mirzoyev, the current leader, actually turned out to have a lot more autonomy and a different way of thinking. But you wouldn't have known because Karimov had sucked all of the oxygen out of the political firmament. Now, in Russia, we've actually got a little bit more information that we know, you know, more about the people who are in the elite groups around Putin. You know, now that there is a war, you're getting all kinds of information coming out, but you still have a, you know, a relatively hard time, you know, figuring out the different connections and whether something is just a random data point or something actually fits together in another context to give you a little bit more information here. So I think all of those things are very important. But again, it underscores how fragile ultimately the system is going to be when you have one person who dominates so much.
So, you know, obviously we'll talk a little bit about what comes after. But before we do, you know, even though, to be honest, you know, I take questions around Putin's physical health with a million grains of salt. But I feel like I'd be
Yeah, you have to.
Right. But I'd be remiss if I didn't bring it up.
Yeah, because I was going to say, because sometimes people might be spreading those rumors to see how other people react. We found that in the case of Uzbekistan, for example, that the rumors were sometimes spread by Karimov himself to see, you know, kind of how his various adversaries within the system, including his own daughter, might react to this.
Well, actually, I did not know that. So, you know, the implication being for Putin, I mean, here's someone whom, you know, there was this video of him tapping his foot. And everybody looked at that video and they're like, oh my God, he's tapping his foot. That must mean that he has Parkinson's.
Yeah. Maybe you thought it was Parkinson's. Well, he could have just been tapping his foot in irritation.
Right.
Let's get this person out of here.
I tap my foot all the time, right? I mean,
I'm doing it now, actually. I'm going to stop. I'm not tapping my foot.
So, yeah. And I wonder, I mean, I've also heard some of the folks on the Ukrainian side. You know, I think one of the intel chiefs or something said something about how some of Putin's appearances were in fact not him, but a body double or something like that. You know, do you place any confidence in any of those assertions?
Well, that, of course, reminds you of the wonderful film, The Death of Stalin.
Yes.
Where one of the first things that happens when Stalin dies is they take out and shoot all the body doubles. But, you know, putting all the humor aside of this, I mean, again, look, this is a sign of a very unhealthy system. Irrespective of how healthy Putin is, this is a sign of deep distress within the political system. Mm. And, you know, I think, again, the very fact that we're speculating about this is showing how brittle it will be and how much everybody is watching, in fact, whether, you know, Putin's up or down his popularity, you know, if is a cold, is that pneumonia, is that this, you know, the beginning of the end? I mean, it is not a good situation for Russia over the longer term or for anybody in the elite to basically have everything dependent on the whims or the health or the mental health of one individual. And Putin himself, I mean, the irony is, he recognized that back in 2007, 2008. It seems such a long time ago and everyone will have forgotten it. But, you know, some of those Valdai meetings and others that I was at, he was talking about the importance of not having all power in one set of hands, the importance of having more of a team. You know, there was all this speculation they might create something of a more robust kind of National Security Council, something that wasn't just a rubber stamp of everything. And then, of course, they created the tandem, the so-called tandem with Dmitry Medvedev, of Medvedev being president while Putin stepped aside for a bit to be prime minister. But then as soon as he came back into power again in 2011, 2012, all that was out the window because, of course, he worried the whole time. And we heard that he was worrying all the time about whether his authority ultimately would be usurped. And now it's back again to one man in charge. And one man in charge and presiding over, you know, a really brutal war with all kinds of uncertainty. So again, it's an unhealthy system, even if we're not entirely clear about how healthy Putin himself is.
So if we were to play out different scenarios, right, I mean, how could this end? You know, we're already hearing Ramzan Kadyrov, the Chechen warlord, Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner group, starting to kind of criticize and go after the Ministry of Defense and the army. You know, we're starting to see some of these divisions. Obviously, they haven't played out. Nobody's really going after Putin or anything like that. But, you know, certainly we've been pushing, you know, the argument to a certain extent. And something that we believe is that in order for something to even be possible, some change to even be possible in Russia, Putin has to lose in Ukraine. That there has to be something decisive that happens there in order to set the stage. So first, I mean, do you agree with that argument? And second, what could happen? You know, what are some, you know, a couple different scenarios that could play out, you know, assuming a loss in Ukraine?
Well, look, just to be frank, he's already lost in Ukraine. I mean, it doesn't necessarily seem like it, and obviously not to him, but he has. I mean, he set in to, I mean, basically have Ukraine immediately surrender and capitulate, kick out Zelensky, and become essentially an extended province of Russia, a bit like Belarus has become under pressure since Lukashenko threw in his lot with Putin after, you know, effectively losing his most recent presidential election. It was clearly that Putin thought within a week to 2 weeks, the whole political system in Ukraine would change without, you know, barely a shot being fired, or at least just, you know, some minimal amount of military activity there. So that's already a loss. And even though Ukraine has obviously suffered greatly from all of this, and Russia itself has suffered, Ukraine can be said, I think, to have had a major military, political, and moral victory at this particular point, not something that Putin would ever have anticipated. So there's other ways in which, you know, he could get squeezed, not just on the battlefield, because, I mean, by this point, I mean, there's so many atrocities, just so much devastation, and, you know, the rest of the world sees this. He could actually lose his grip on the broader international public. I'm a bit doubtful at this point that he's losing it inside of Russia itself, but I think there are ways in which we could play that out. Because I keep hearing stories from you know, the elite circles around Putin, that people are doubling down with him, you know, that they're reacting to all of this, you know, the idea that Russia's been cancelled in international affairs with anger, feeling humiliated and having that, you know, classic psychological rejection of all of that and, you know, doubling down with him. I mean, that's not the whole population, but certainly in many of the people who surround him and those circles around the Kremlin that intersect even in the intelligentsia. I mean, I think we see a lot of the population are very unhappy and are literally running away from the conflict and also from Russia itself. But in the international arena, I mean, what Putin is playing for at the moment is to be the leader of the, you know, what used to be the non-aligned movement, not the West, but the rest, playing to Latin America and Africa and Asia, the so-called Global South, trying to cash in on the limitless partnership that President Xi announced between China and Russia on the eve of this war, and trying in many respects to create a completely alternate bloc to the West. And look, if that is not feasible, if the US and other larger international and Ukrainian diplomacy works to constrain Putin in the international arena, constrain his room for maneuver, you get more public and more outspoken criticism of what Russia is doing, you know, by China and India and other countries, that could also be a mechanism for change. So, I mean, Putin's, you know, thinking all of, you know, this through with you right now, Putin's position inside of Russia, it's not just dependent on what happens in the battlefield on Ukraine, because, you know, right now, I mean, even if he consolidates the gains that he has in some fashion, he's already lost what he, you know, set out to do at this juncture. But it also depends very much on his standings, his ranking within the population writ large, and then whether the elite have confidence in him. And there are different kinds of elites, right? I mean, we all know that many of the business elites, economic elites, are completely fed up with this. You know, everything that they've worked for the last 30 years since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, since the 1990s and the economic chaos, is now out the window. We've seen a lot of oligarchs giving up their Russian citizenship. Not a lot, but I said a notable number. Again, we've seen a lot of the high tech, you know, the best and the brightest leaving Russia at this particular point. But we've also, as you've said, seen people like Yevgeny Prigozhin, Ramzan Kadyrov, and others in what we would say is the party of war coming out pretty assertively. They're either trying to goad Putin on, you know, sort of testing out the waters, or they may also be testing out who else is likely to rise now. Because there is a group of people who want Putin to turn things around on the battlefield and who want to be more brutal with Ukraine and, you know, don't care at all about how the West or everyone else reacts and kind of want to sort of humiliate the West as well, the kind of war with the West party as well as the war with Ukraine party. And Putin could very easily get squeezed by them because he's not going to be able to satisfy them, especially if they see that his international status is flagging. And also knowing that his popularity at the level of the population is also trickling away. You know, so their internal polling, I mean, you know, we keep hearing all the time that people are still in interviews saying they support Vladimir Putin. But that's like, you know, do you support your country in a time of war question? As much as it, do you want to be in the gulag for the next 11 years if you answer this question incorrectly? You know, because there's so much repression and, you know, so much tension within Russia right now that answering that question is difficult, but, you know, I would say for most people. So I think that there's a lot going on there that could put Putin in a difficult position. And I often say, and, you know, whether I'm right or not is another question we'll have to see, that 2024 as an inflection point about when he's supposed to be, you know, re-elected yet again or re-anointed as president, becomes an important point in the system. How do all of these factors play together then? And does it actually kind of look like to some of those elites that they might be better off with a different person and moving Vladimir to one side?
So we've delved into the context and the history around Putin, around Russia. And I want to look a little bit on the Ukrainian side. And here, I don't want to go too far back into the past, but I do think you would have a kind of a unique perspective on some more recent history, which is, you know, the first time that I think most Americans heard Volodymyr Zelensky's name was during the first impeachment hearings, right? And as we all know, thanks to the bravery of RDI board member Alex Vindman, former President Trump tried to blackmail Zelensky to start an investigation of Biden. And this all happened not too long before Russia's invasion. And so that seems kind of awfully coincidental, right? That suddenly you have Zelensky, who is arguably now one of the single most, if not the single most famous person in the world, having come to public attention, you know, just a year beforehand in an impeachment of an American president. To what extent do you think these two events are related or coincidental or whatever else?
Look, I think there's a direct line between the two. And I think some of it is obvious, right? I mean, Russia in particular, and Putin would have been watching those events as well and taken away from that, not just the perfect phone call, the very imperfect phone call between Trump and Zelensky, but having watched it for a very long time about how Trump behaved vis-a-vis Ukraine. I mean, it was pretty obvious to Putin that Trump had also bought into the idea that somehow Ukraine was a problem for him, Trump, rather than Russia. He wanted to believe that. But Putin would have seen the fact that Trump didn't take Ukraine seriously. In fact, he saw it as a political plaything. And there was an assumption the entire time on the part of the Russians, and I know that from my own interactions with people like Nikolai Patrushev when I was at the National Security Council, you know, at the same time that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was there as well. But we would have these meetings with our counterparts, the National Security Council in Russia, and they would say things like, well, what's Ukraine to you? Not believing that there was any genuine interest on the part of the United States in Ukraine, and that there was just some kind of proxy in some kind of back and forth with Russia, or a proxy and a plaything in our own internal politics. So I think Putin becomes convinced that the United States is just not serious about Ukraine. And certainly, you know, he was probably waiting to see whether Trump would get in or not, you know, after 2020, because he was pretty convinced that Trump didn't care at all about Ukraine, not the slightest. I mean, the fact that he would, you know, be trading off potential political favors from Zelensky, even at a time of war between Ukraine and Russia, which was still going on, in a return for a White House visit and, you know, more seriously, military aid, I mean, it's proof to him that the United States is just all over the place, not serious at all. And I think, you know, when Biden comes in, Putin's sort of testing him out for a bit to sort of see where the United States is. And we think about Geneva in June of 2021. Putin definitely wanted to negotiate with Biden there. And he wanted to negotiate with him on big issues related to nuclear weapons and European security. But he wanted to test to see if Biden was willing to give up Ukraine in return for all of these issues. And remember, he's, you know, purported to have said, this has been, you know, publicly reported in different places, well, the United States won't negotiate with us, so we'll just have to, you know, move ahead. Because he genuinely thinks that the United States thinks of Ukraine as a plaything, as a pawn. And he was trying to see if Biden would give it up. So, you know, then Biden says, we're not having negotiation, you know, with Russia about Ukraine, over the head of Ukraine and over the head of Europeans, you know, for European security. And Putin, you know, then clearly thinks, well, then we'll just have to, you know, go in there and take it. Again, assuming that because we're not serious, we wouldn't actually do anything. I mean, it's a kind of a complete and utter misreading of the situation and everybody talking past each other because they're all working in a different frame. And it goes again all the way back to that impeachment trial, which the whole world watched that. And realize that, you know, certainly Trump didn't care at all about national security and he damn well didn't care about Ukraine.
Yeah, hard to argue with that. So Biden met with Putin three times.
Yeah.
Right, prior to the invasion. There was one in-person meeting and the two virtual ones. What role, if any, do you think those played in Putin's ultimate decision to invade Ukraine? And I mean, the question kind of underlying the question is, I mean, to what extent would you have advised him to take those meetings, to not take those meetings, what to say and or do in those meetings? Is the simple act of offering a meeting to someone like Putin with the leader of the free world a concession in and of itself? Or is that the wrong way to think about it?
No, I don't think it's a concession. I think it's important. I mean, look, we've got Bill Burns going to Moscow. Well, actually, no, to Ankara to meet with his counterpart, Naryshkin.
For listeners who want some entertainment, I highly recommend that you Google Naryshkin, one of Putin's chief intelligence advisors, N-A-R-Y-S-H.
Yeah, the foreign intelligence
advisor. Yeah, the intelligence advisor. I mean, yeah. There's a brilliant video like a couple of days before the invasion where it comes out where Putin's asking Naryshkin, you know, whether or not Russia should invade Ukraine. And Naryshkin is just terrified out of his mind. I mean, you could see the fear in his eyes and that he could do that with his intel advisor is, I think, quite telling. I mean, the video is about 1 minute long and it's just, absolutely an incredible, I think, video event. But anyway, apologies, go on.
This is really significant, Odile, because, you know, what Putin did was he, you know, made this decision to invade behind the backs of most of his national security team. And I suppose that might raise the question, well, why is Bill Burns bothering to go meet with, you know, Mr. Naryshkin, who was clearly out of the loop? But it's important for messaging. It's important to try to get the measure of where people are. So I don't think that, you know, meeting is ever any kind of concession. Look, from the point of view of someone in intelligence, it's an important collection. That's why Putin likes to meet with people. He wants to, you know, size them up, scope them out, and, you know, see what they're trying to do. And I think that, you know, basically, it was very important for Biden to talk to Putin, to convey messages. But I think, you know, by the problem that we had was really, you know, trying to dissuade or deter Putin from doing something he'd already clearly made his mind up about. And what Putin was trying to do was sort of test to see whether there was any way that Biden would give him something without his having to resort to force. This is Putin. Because Putin, as I said before, he's very calculating. He tries to think, well, how can he get this for the least effort, honestly? But if it has to take in a bit of effort, you know, he's willing to be ruthless, more ruthless than, you know, we're usually prepared to be. And he'll put in that effort and then see, you know, what's going to happen. He's just trying to figure out what the price is, you know, for getting people to give him a concession and to compromise. And he's still doing that in Ukraine. He's constantly escalating to see how far everyone will go. And see, that was, you know, perhaps that we hadn't fully processed. Although I think by, you know, we time to get into 2021 and by the time of the meeting in Geneva, people like Bill Burns have already actually been out there, you know, to Russia and said, hey, look, we can see that you're massing on the borders here of Ukraine, both in Belarus and then in Russia itself and Crimea, of course, which is still part of Ukraine, but, you know, using the platform that they've built in the annexed territory to amass against the borders, looking like it's for a military attack. And, you know, trying to basically say, we know what you're trying to do here, you know, don't do it. I mean, that was an important aspect of it, but it's clear, and Naryshkin obviously didn't really know, but it's clear that Putin had made his mind up that he was going to actually, if he didn't get what he wanted from any kind of negotiation, that he was going to do something. And by December of 2021, when the Russian government sends demands, again, we've all forgotten about this, to the United States about withdrawing from Europe, essentially, basically saying that not just should Ukraine not become part of NATO, but NATO should pull back to its pre-1997 borders. I mean, basically before any of the other countries joined NATO, taking, you know, troops and, you know, installations there, and talking about the complete demilitarization of Ukraine and then the United States taking out missiles and troops from Europe. It became clear at that point that Putin had decided to move ahead. Now, what we're trying to do right now with meetings is to try to deter Russia from using a nuclear weapon and from, you know, basically taking this into a completely different threshold. Now, one might suggest from the previous meetings that we didn't do very well last time. Are we going to do any better this time? But of course, the last time was before Putin had actually done something. And now everybody sees what Putin is capable of, what Putin has done. And everybody's not just the US Western allies. We were very skeptical before February of 2022 that Russia was about to invade, but the rest of the world has seen it as well. So the game has changed. It's a very different situation than it was before.
You brought up what I think Putin hopes is the magic word, right? Nuclear.
Right.
And, you know, that's the saber he's been wielding to try to get the rest of the world to back down. And, you know, my big fear is that as part of these negotiations, and I mean, we're seeing it happen to some extent, that, you know, we have not given Ukraine the unmanned aerial vehicles that they've been asking for. We've not given them the sufficient tracked vehicles that they've been asking for, long-range missiles they've been asking for, even sufficient aerial defense in order to be able to defend their cities from the Russian missile barrages, where I got this just, you know, completely unbelievable email from a colleague of mine in Kyiv, saying, Kyiv is under attack, we're all in shelters, can we please reschedule our Zoom? Which was just, you know, a surreal email to receive. But anyway, so my fears in trying to kind of, I mean, again, I don't want to use the word appease, but I guess in trying to avoid escalation and thereby not giving Ukraine that sort of advanced weaponry that would allow them to make advances more quickly, we are in effect obviously consigning more Ukrainians to death, and we're also prolonging the war. And prolonging the war actually is a risk all of its own, which is to say, you know, that the missile that landed in Poland, at this point, it seems like it was likely a Ukrainian air defense missile that misfired rather than a Russian missile. But nevertheless, those kinds of mistakes, the likelihood of those mistakes increases as the war goes on. And so that kind of begs the question, number one, do you think that there's a risk to sort of even these kinds of very quiet, you know, back channel types of conversations that only make it to the press, you know, days after the fact. Do you think there's a risk to not, quote unquote, escalating, right? To not giving Ukraine these types of weapons? And then obviously, last but not least, you know, what's your assessment of the nuclear question?
Well, look, it's a combination of those things, right? I mean, I think you've got to give Ukraine as much support as you possibly can, but also keep on keeping those channels open and basically say, look, we're doing this because of what you're doing, because Ukraine has the absolute right to defend itself. And you, Russia, have made all kinds of commitments to upholding Ukraine's territorial independence and sovereignty, which is actually true. And that also ties into the nuclear issue. Russia's made multiple commitments, including in Geneva in 2021, at the request of the Russians, to basically uphold previous commitments made by the Soviet Union and the United States and Gorbachev and Reagan, for example, that nuclear war was impermissible. Now, I suppose Russia might argue that it's not really much of a nuclear war if only it drops a, you know, nuclear weapon on Ukraine, but, you know, nonetheless, they've crossed a threshold. And of course, we know that Putin's been trying to make this linkage with the precedent of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 and the United States basically detonating nuclear weapons over Japan to end the war in Asia. Now, the war in Europe had already ended, of course, by this point, but Putin's trying to basically kind of say, well, you know, if it's permissible for the United States to use nuclear weapons to end a war, then, you know, we want to be able to do this as well. But at this point, we've noticed that rhetoric has gone down a bit because the United States has been pushing these messages very clearly. And again, Bill Burns' meeting with Narishkin in Turkey is another part of that. But there's also been a lot of, you know, activity with President Biden meeting with President Xi of China. You know, the big difference of the past, the Soviet period, is we're not the only nuclear superpowers. Now, there were obviously after World War II, three other permanent nuclear powers, China, France, and the United Kingdom, but they weren't really nuclear superpowers. China, I would say now, is getting up there for being a nuclear superpower. You've also had lots of proliferation. You've got India and you've got Pakistan, North Korea, Iran, you know, all with, you know, all kinds of aspirations there. The world is a much more complicated and dangerous place in terms of the capacity and capability for other countries to upset the nuclear balance as well. And if you're China, there is no way that you want to see, you know, basically a flood of countries rushing off the nuclear weapons for defensive purposes or creating the same kind of mechanisms that we have in Europe, where a very strong signal from Sweden and Finland for joining NATO that they want to be under the nuclear umbrella of the NATO alliance, not just there for, you know, the other aspects of collective security and mutual defense. It's precisely because Russia has been shaking the nuclear saber with as much force as it possibly can that Sweden and Finland have made that decision. Because a few years ago, Sweden was leading the charge at the United Nations, along with other countries, to have a ban on nuclear weapons. And it's not that the Swedes are hypocrites. It's because of the whole, you know, situation has changed because of what Putin has done. And if you ask the Finns, why did they suddenly change their minds after decades of not wanting to be in NATO, it's precisely because of this and all the other atrocities and horrible things that the Russians have done in Ukraine. So it's completely changed the calculation. So what my assessment is on this is, of course, Putin is the kind of person to think about how I can use something really nasty to do as many devastating things I possibly can, because he's already using autonomous weapons, drones that he's got from Iran, you know, to basically swarm Ukraine and take out all of its infrastructure. So why would he not want to use something that could have a massive psychological effect as well as some kind of, you know, perhaps more contained battlefield effect? Because he knows it's a psychological weapon as much as anything else. But the whole point then is of pushing back diplomatically and internationally. And I think that's what we all have to do and what the Biden administration and many others are doing as well. I mean, we've fallen into Putin's trap by talking about it all the time. That's what he wants us to do. But we haven't so far then sat down and said, here, have Ukraine. I mean, some people are out there arguing about it because that's what he wants. He wants to get us now to hand over Ukraine so that he doesn't detonate a nuclear weapon. The blackmail aspect of this could not be more apparent. And we absolutely have to make it sure that we will not frame any kind of future discussion on his terms like that.
On that note, why aren't we providing the more advanced weaponry that could allow Ukraine to make advances on the battlefield without a kind of a single American or NATO boot on the ground, right? I mean, we haven't given them ATACMS missiles, which would enable them to better defend and attack Russian positions. We haven't given them tracked vehicles, which would help them make more efficient, quicker advances in open territory, especially when there's mud or snow or, you know, whatever else on the ground. We haven't given them unmanned aerial vehicles. You know, there's a whole host of things we could give them, which, you know, the question is definitely not of cost, right? These things are, I mean, they're more expensive, but they're not insanely more expensive than what we've already provided. They're simply a different nature of weapon that we have thus far decided not to give to them. And when I met with the Germans, for example, and asked them about giving tanks or infantry mobility vehicles, their first and quite frankly, their only real response was, well, America hasn't given them. You know, we're not going to be holier than the Pope. So why is that, right? I mean, are we missing an opportunity here?
I think things are starting to shift somewhat. And, you know, part of it is people are still hoping that this can be ended in, you know, some more contained time frame. And in many respects, a lot of this is debates about how much do you hold back, you know, depending on how far you think this is going to go and how long it's going to go and the nature of this conflict. I mean, we've heard over the last few days, especially after, you know, the errant missile parts going into Poland, clearly an accident as a result of, you know, Ukraine's trying to shoot down, you know, yet another, you know, attack on them by the Russians, that there's a great concern about, you know, the direct involvement of NATO. And the Russians seem concerned about that too, the desire to sort of contain it within Ukraine itself. But look, this war is already spilled over borders in all kinds of different ways. Refugees, you know, the grain and energy and, you know, other blockades and activities that, you know, Russia is undertaking, cyber attacks, I mean, you name it, influence operations. There's all kinds of things going on here. I think what we really need to do is for people to fully process the situation that we're dealing with, which is a great power conflict. We're in a war. Putin has declared war on the West. We're just trying to figure out about how we're going to manage it and how we're going to deal with it over what might prove to be the longer term. So I think this is going to be a fluid situation, which people are going to be talking more and more about all kinds of issues. I mean, I think already in the German realm, for example, I had a recent meeting just in the last couple of days that suggests that that debate's also moving on in a different, you know, set of directions. Because the more that people see what Putin is doing, that escalation on the ground in Ukraine, that destruction that you see, the more that people are contemplating the kinds of things that you're talking about here. So a lot of it's dependent on what Putin does too. But what he's trying to do, of course, is to appeal for all the others who don't want to give more support to Ukraine, because it is costly. And it's a question about our own inventories and our own, you know, manufacturing and who's paying and what's the kind of the other analysis about, you know, what other security issues might be put at risk in some context by putting everything in the war in Ukraine. We see that Russia's put everything in that war, actually, which is really quite astounding. Showing that this really matters a heck of a lot to Putin. And in fact, he's exposed himself on all kinds of other flanks as well, pulling troops out of the Russian Far East, out of Central Asia, out of the borders, you know, with Finland and Norway. It's all full on, you know, on Ukraine now. And I think, you know, we have to, again, really be focused on this and analysing, you know, what's happening and how things are all playing out there. But I think, you know, like the bottom line is we're in for the long haul here in terms of this conflict. Because even if Putin does manage to persuade people that it's time for a ceasefire, that's not the end by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, I think what he's trying to do right now is horrify enough people so much that they will push for basically a ceasefire and for kind of an end of that conflict, but it will not be the end.
Last point here, not to try to pin you down here or anything, but would you advise the administration then to provide some of these more advanced capabilities, given that, you know, per your assessment, we are in this for the long haul?
It has to be done in conjunction with others as well, which is not a cop-out here, but I think it's got to be very important. This is another element of it. Putin wants to make this a US-Russia war. It must not be a US-Russia war, because that then gives him the upper hand, the strategic advantage in pressing for an end to this conflict. The focus absolutely has to be on, this is Russia have invaded Ukraine and we need to give Ukraine what it needs, you know, to basically liberate itself or personally roll back Russia as absolutely as far as it can. And it has to be a concerted effort, both militarily and diplomatically, on an international frame. I think the biggest risk that we have is turning this into a US-Russia conflict, because that's when Ukraine will become unbelievably vulnerable, because it will just be a pawn, which is what Putin wants it to be, in what Putin is trying to paint as a sort of existential battle with the United States and the West. And there's a lot of the rest of the world believes that. So what I'm trying to do here is to be more careful about it, because you don't want to play into what Putin wants. So you have to be able to, you know, frame this in a way that is beneficial for Ukraine, first of all, which is why the administration is always making it very clear that Ukraine is first. So if Ukraine decides and Ukrainians decide to go down a different path, we have to go down that path with them. But, you know, I would basically advise the United States and other countries to give Ukraine as much as they possibly can to help Ukraine defend itself and roll Russia back. And I'm not an expert on different weapon systems either, so I'm not the best person to ask whether I'd give them this over that. You know, but I think, you know, military experts really know, you know, what it is that would be the most useful for Ukraine to have and who has it and how we might be able to craft that.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. Give Ukraine whatever they need, whatever they want, or as much as feasible to end this as quickly as we can.
Yeah, you can't give everybody everything that they want, because sometimes it's just not feasible. And I do actually want to leave people just knowing, because I mean, you know, from what I know in government, it's often not that simple. I mean, things have to be produced. They might not be available. It may be that other countries, not the United States, have them, for example. I mean, I remember many incidents myself, you know, the broader work that we're doing in Europe where we were looking for, you know, particular systems, and the United States actually didn't have them. Sometimes it was the Norwegians or the Swedes or, you know, somebody else, for example.
Well, Fiona, thank you so much for joining. Really appreciate it. And with that, I want to thank you all for listening to this episode of Winter is Here, brought to you by the Renew Democracy Initiative. I'm your host, Uriel Epstein. At RDI, we are committed to pulling American democracy back from the brink and restoring its place as a global beacon for freedom. If you'd like to support the show, please subscribe for free in your podcast player at renewdemocracy.substack.com and share the episode with a friend, or become an RDI subscriber at rdi.org. Thank you.